think there is a strong appetite on campus, particularly among young people, for a serious and honest debate about questions that have been taboo, questions surrounding race, ethnicity, to a lesser degree, gender and sexual orientation as well. For a long time, policies like racial preferences have been prosecuted, but behind closed doors.
Cultural conflicts, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for a conversation featuring Stanley Fish of Duke University and Dinesh D'Souza of the American Enterprise Institute. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. American education has lately become the staging ground for a battle with many fronts. At issue are questions of race, ethnicity, gender, and sexual orientation, and the ways they affect the undergraduate curriculum. Two prominent voices in the controversy belong to Dinesh D'Souza and Stanley Fish, who over the past year or so have engaged in a series of debates about the nature and direction of American education. According to Dinesh D'Souza, he and Stanley Fish have become totemic figures in the controversy, frequently pushed into extreme positions that neither necessarily holds. To illuminate the conditions that underscore today's competition of cultural and educational values, Soundings invited Stanley Fish and Dinesh D'Souza to reflect on their series of debates, which included appearances at the University of South Florida, Northern Illinois University, Pennsylvania State University at Erie, the University of Alabama, and Center College in Kentucky. Here is Dinesh D'Souza.
Well, I think that my role has been to be in part a journalist, in part a scholar, in part a critic of the academy, with one foot inside the academy and the other foot outside it, to some degree applying a policy or political lens to the academy. Professor Fish, I think, plays into some degree a different role because he has been cast as the defender of the academy, and yet I think he bears an ambivalent relationship to many of his constituencies who come out to hear him preach. This turned out to be interestingly exposed at some of the campuses where we spoke, where, for example, Professor Fish would articulate ideas that would upset or confuse or flummox activists on the left who expected him to rather uncritically sloganeer on their behalf.
I have Stanley on tape admitting that he is a conservative in many ways that his friends and enemies won't acknowledge.
Well, in fact, I just returned from a visit to Johns Hopkins where I spoke on the First Amendment, and a letter is waiting on my desk, I am told, from a professor of political science who is taking me to task for hewing to a line that is known to be a conservative line, and therefore I assume I haven't read the entire letter, taking me to a task for having betrayed the kind of constituency that Dinesh spoke of. I think that when people came to see us, they got, I don't know whether flummoxed would be the right word, but they got helpfully disoriented by both of our performances.
I've said this before, that, you know, politically I feel comfortable describing myself as a conservative, and yet in education I think of myself as a liberal. And so, for example, on the free speech issue, I've been defending a classical First Amendment point of view, and Professor Fish has become, in some sense, a critic of that. I do think that the idea of politics is relevant here, and it's not, and the contemporary manifestation, if you will, of the left within the academy is not a debate over strategic defense or a debate over or even over capitalism. It's a debate over what I call domestic liberation movements, focusing on race, on gender, and so on. To that degree, I think Stanley Fish does reflect the championing of new forms of scholarship, a defense of affirmative action, a defense of gay rights, a defense of perceived emancipation of oppressed groups within the academy.
How do you feel about being criticized for taking this show on the road? Stanley has told me that there was a blurb in the New Republic which said basically that each of you has dignified the other position by rising to the challenge.
And Stanley? Also getting paid for it. Yeah. I think that the New Republic's jibe at both of us was a jibe for making a commodity out of what was supposedly a serious issue. I feel that we gave value for what we received, that we were asked by universities where interest, largely student body interest, was expressed, because most of the, if not all, of the arrangements were made in relation to funds earmarked for student bodies to invite us. So that instead of inviting a rock group or Louis Farrakhan or someone, they invited the two of us and got a sustained intellectual slash political debate. And I think that's a tribute to the student bodies rather than a basis of criticism.
A lot of these colleges are funded by activities fees. Students pay $10 or $15 a year, which doesn't seem like much, but when you have 35 or 40,000 students on the campus, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
I went to a conference on ethnicity at the University of Colorado, and I seemed to be the only person talking about ideas there. They had La Bamba, the group from Mexico, playing. They had Native American dances. They had barbecues from exotic places around the world. Very often, our debates have tended to be the intellectual components of larger multicultural industries. A second point is that the thing in the New Republic was amusing, and I think a reflection more of the kind of envy of political journalists at the New Republic, many of whom are themselves on the speaker circuit, but as one intern there put it to me, generally don't tend to command as good an honorarium as Professor Fish and me. So I guess that tends to be the kind of give and take within journalistic squabbles.
It's also a function of the general ambivalence, and one might even say at some levels hypocrisy, with which the academy is viewed, both inside and outside the academy. That is, there's this old sense, which some academics believe and others distrust, and I'm one of those, that to be an academic is to be a form of a priest, an acolyte, and that one takes vows of a variety of kinds, and that therefore one should never accept honoraria or only accept small and modest honoraria. On the other hand, there's a great deal of talk from all quarters about how crucial and important educational matters are to the country and to the health of the Republic, indeed, of the world. So it would seem to me that if that is the case, and if every magazine and newspaper is continually running stories about the problems of the Academy, then it would seem that we would be the appropriate persons to ask to be asked and to be remunerated.
You know, well, I'm kind of reminded about the artist who was offered a grant by the National Endowment for the Arts, but was very disturbed at efforts on the part of the NEH to regulate the content of art that was sponsored by the government. And the statement he made to the press was, it was about whether or not he should in fact accept his grant. And he says, "I could have refused the money, but that would have been the easy thing to do."
It never crossed my mind.
Apropos of Stanley's comments here about the relationship between the academy, the universities, and the larger world, without replicating this debate, this argument that you two have engaged in, Stanley, why are the humanities the object of all of this educational criticism? I mean, we have the sciences, and on one side of the ledger, people seem to look at the newspapers and they'll look at budgets and they'll say, well, that's necessary. Science is a good thing. Let's give them the money and we won't really probe.
Well, I think in part it's
the humanities, by contrast.
It's an interesting relationship between the science and the humanities to the idea of mystification. Mystification is perfectly appropriate, the general public feels, in scientific matters, because scientific matters are the province of experts, and we would not feel comfortable with scientists unless they spoke a vocabulary much more arcane than ours. Literary matters, or matters of history, or matters of the history of art, even matters of anthropology, are supposedly available to the common sense consideration of a general public. And therefore, when the general public hears that the humanities are engaging in activities that seem hermetic, that seem difficult of access, there is a response. It doesn't fit into the general notion of what humanities scholarship is about. Another way to put it, in perhaps a more succinct way, is to say that there's never been an understanding and an acceptance of the humanities as research disciplines, as opposed to curators in a museum-like way, of a set of almost sacred texts. Now, there could be an argument. In fact, there is an argument that that humanities departments should not be research departments. But that is nevertheless what they are. And so that I think this shock of surprise makes the humanities an easy target.
But research toward what end? I would say that the two ends for scholarship have always been first, the end of truth, and second, the end of utility. Now, the reason for the prestige of science is first, science satisfies the debate about truth. There tends to be empirical, verifiable modes of checking claims of error, ways of revising old paradigms, ways of bringing, in a sense, the entire field into line on a given proposition. And second, utility, the benefits of technology and so on. Now, the humanities have always suffered from the disrepute of not contributing to utility. What the heck do you do with an English major? But I think the prestige of the humanities hinged almost entirely on its ability to be a quest for truth. And I think that within the humanities itself, that notion has become controversial, to say the least, the notion that truth is even available to be accessed. And so I think this has created a crisis. As I put it in my book, I say if the humanities does not teach us to distinguish what's right from what's wrong, what's beautiful from what's vulgar, what's the point of it, really?
Well, I think that there's some truth to that, although I would say in partial disagreement that the question of the status of the quest for truth has in recent years become as much a matter of dispute in the scientific community as in the humanities community. But I do believe that traditional rationales for the humanities, that is the rationale which made humanities professors or humanities departments the custodians of a cultural heritage, have been questioned from within the humanities, and that does, as Dinesh just said, leave the humanities without an obvious rationale. And I believe that it's incumbent upon the humanities to formulate a rationale that will be both true to its own activities and responsive to the public's concerns. I do not believe that the humanities have met this task, and that therefore the appearance of critics like Dinesh is one to which the humanities must respond in a more considerate and deliberate way than it so far has.
Well, now, one of the problems that the humanities faces is getting the word out. I want to hear what you have to say about the kind of coverage, that is to say, the way what went on in this exchange between the two of you, Dinesh D'Souza, Stanley Fish, got to the public. Were you happy with that?
Well, I think we both are, and part of the reason for that is that Professor Fish, unlike a lot of academics, is very good, I think, at making the case to a general colloquial audience. Somebody once asked him on a campus, what is your definition of deconstruction? And I was sort of waiting for the worst, but he said, well, the difference is illustrated in the difference between the old Star Trek and the new Star Trek. And then he went on to give examples and show how the new Star Trek could never have operated on the assumptions of the old, much as we may like both, and show that one universe had been replaced by another. My point is, students can understand, and a larger public can understand arguments placed in those terms. Now, I don't simply think, though, that this is a debate about making complex ideas accessible. There was a meeting of a group of scholars that the Chronicle of Higher Education covered recently. They were discussing how to meet, how to respond to the public critique of PC or political correctness. And all these professors says, well, we've all got to get together and write op-ed articles in the New York Times.
Where was this?
This was reported in the Chronicle of Higher Education. I don't remember where the conference took place. But then one professor stood up and said, well, there's a big problem behind all this, and that is that it's not simply a matter of us writing op-ed articles. The general public is somewhat hostile to many of the values that we're trying to communicate in the classroom. You know, we want to champion experimental programs in gay studies. We want to pursue these socially activist projects, and these are not going to meet with very much public sympathy. So it's not simply a matter of communication. It's a matter that the message itself is very controversial.
Stanley?
I agree with that, and I think that does, in fact, give the academy, or at least that part of the academy which is interested, to use Dinesh's phrase, in pursuing experimental programs, a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
But presumably, since humanities professors, like any other academics, believe themselves to be intelligent, capable, and verbal, they should rise to the challenge.
Why is it that the universities have such difficulty with PR? I mean, that's one of the issues here, is it not, Stanley?
Yes, it is. And I think the answer that I would give is the academic disdain for what we might call, in a almost jargon-like phrase, accessing the public. The academic community still has more than a residue of the intellectual contempt for those who have not had the same training and engaged in the same activities as academics. And this also has played very badly in the press, because the press, members of the press, not the entire press, but members of the press, I know, feel that academics, when they speak to them, are speaking to them in ways that are demeaning. And this is in fact the case. And if you recognize, as you must, the power of the press in these matters, you should also recognize that a press that feels that it is being talked down to or disdained will respond in ways that correspond to its power. And that is what has happened in part in this discussion. I fault the Academy. I do not fault Dinesh for having written his book. He wrote his book. He did the work. It's up to those who disagree with the conclusions that he draws to make their disagreements viable and accessible to the same level that he made his criticism viable and accessible.
Have you changed your mind on any of these issues because of writing the book and going on this debate circuit with Stanley Fish, Dinesh?
And others.
And others.
Well, I would not say that my opinions have been changed, but my interests have focused more in the area of reform proposals and trying to figure out what to do, because I think the best arguments for many existing university policies are that if they were not adopted, we are going to go back to the bad old days of the past, an Anshian regime in which I have no vested interest whatsoever. And so I think it's incumbent upon people like me who are trying to critique the system to come up with sensible alternatives. The second point I'd make is that it's puzzled me about why there's so much public and press criticism of political correctness, because if there are any enclaves of liberal or left-wing thought in America today, you'll find a lot of it in the press. And so I wondered why are like-minded people turning against their ideologically sympathetic colleagues within the Academy? Well, there are a couple of reasons, I think, for it. One is the obvious First Amendment sympathy or bias of the press. But a second, I think, is that guys from the press, who are themselves, to some degree, a lot of them products of the 60s, feel that they are anchored in the real world, that they are empirical, they interview people, they cover events, they show up at the fire, they show up at the global conference on warming, and they feel that their opinions are revised in the light of the trajectory of changing events. And I think they view the Academy as an enclave removed from the real world where ideas fester rather than develop. And they view professors as being, in a sense, lost within in the nostalgic enclaves of the 60s, and they like to show their sophistication and modernity to some degree by criticizing the Academy.
But that, of course, has what Dinesh has just said, with which I agree again, highlights the kind of double bind in which the university is placed. Most people want the universities to be removed from the real world in certain ways. That is, they don't want to see certain kinds of things happening. You often find criticisms of the university starting with, in a university, it should be the case that, meaning not as it is in the real world. And then the universities will turn around and be criticized for not being in the real world. Now, this is almost an inevitable consequence of the university's uneasy situation between academic study on the one hand and industry and government on the other. Not enough thinking. Again, my theme is always, I'm preaching a message today to universities. Universities have not thought enough about the kinds of questions that have been raised in this debate, and if they continue not to think about these kinds of questions, they will flounder on just as they have been doing in the past year and a half, trying to mount a response to criticism.
Well, one of the institutions that's become very controversial in American life recently is the Supreme Court and the court generally. And one obvious reason for that is the question, who does the court answer to? Who is it accountable to? Nobody elects these people. They tell us how we should live our lives. They frame the rules under which we live. Accountability. And I think the university suffers the same problem. Who is the university accountable to? Yes, it should be an enclave. But this is an enclave that is being very heavily funded. It's funded by parents. It's funded by alumni. It's funded by state legislators. It's funded by corporations and donors. Is the university responding to these communities? Does it have any obligation to do so? I think universities have become detached from those who are both subsidizing them and those who are supposed to benefit from them, and this is creating a real problem.
This is not a question we've ever discussed before, so I don't mind opening up a debate on this line because it's so new. I would say the issue isn't so much accountability, or rather I would say that accountability can only even be considered if a university community first has a sense of its mission, what it is that it's there doing, what it stands for. My criticism of universities today is that most of them don't have that kind of vision because they have capitulated to an ultra-liberal, almost libertarian notion of individual rights and feel incapable of formulating community notions of goals and aspirations to which they themselves might be hold themselves responsible and which they might present to the public. Undergraduates come to a university, in my view, not to be able to say or think anything they like, but in order to be able to join a community which has some interest in leading them in some direction.
On this point, we're in complete agreement. In fact, I think many of our debates about multiculturalism and so on, the argument is not over what is offered on campus, but over what is required, over a sense of priorities. And my feeling is that since the 60s, colleges have moved away from requirements. There's virtually nothing that everybody has to take, including a math major and a physics major, to graduate. Right. At Berkeley, there's only one course that you absolutely have to take in order to get a degree, and that's ethnic studies. So the argument is one of requirements. I personally would like to see a lot more requirements in which, and if you had a lot of requirements dominating your freshman year, you could have Western and non-Western requirements. You could read Plato and the Quran. You could have a rather inclusive curriculum, which is what the multiculturalists want, and it's what the traditionalists want, too.
Although I agree with the goal, I would not think that requirements was necessarily the way to reach it. That is, I think if you had a university which was everywhere in form by articulated senses of purpose, you could then structure classes and team teaching and interdisciplinary programs in such a way that requirements per se would not themselves be required. Although the end result, I think, that Dinesh and I would wish to see would be somewhat the same.
Do you think that this debate that you have been through, do you think this is going to change American education in any appreciable or measurable sense?
Our debate?
Yeah. I mean, after all, you did it for something more than the money, I take it,
I think
it, Stanley.
That, we're, both of us are oars in the water, and there's a very large a boat being navigated here. And as I found when I worked in the White House, one can only infinitesimally alter the overall course of events. And what you hope is simply that your incremental leverage will have some beneficial
impact. But surely
impact.
You haven't been through a useless exercise together. That's my point.
Well, look, you're not through a useless exercise if certain kinds of things happen. At the Penn State Erie debate, we were shepherded, Dinesh and I were shepherded by the president of the National Association of Scholars chapter on that campus. He and I had some interesting discussions. When I returned from Pennsylvania, I received from him the most wonderful letter and a small gift. Now, it was without a doubt, didn't mean that he had come around to my views. But what he did say was that he appreciated the articulation of those views in contrast and sometimes in opposition to Dinesh's. I'm sure that he was one particularly articulate respondent, but who stood in for many others. Mm-hmm. And if that happened to one person, made them reflect, made them think, made them see what the other kind of argument was like, why it might be mounted, it must have happened in the minds of many students and faculty from whom neither of us has heard.
One of the charges is that a lot of this stuff comes down to individual personality power politics. It makes me happy to see the two of you sitting at least congenially exchanging your views here in front of a microphone. You seem to be good friends, and yet you are characterized as polar opposites.
Well, we're vehemently opposed on stage, and I would say that we've had. One of the reporters at our debate said he was surprised by, how fierce some of our opposition was. And yet we can have a drink afterward, and we've even played a couple of sets of tennis. And that's been one of the gratifying things for me about debating Stanley Fish. I've debated really a rogues gallery of characters now over the last year. And I find that because the topic is controversial and difficult, it's very bitter for a lot of people. And they don't want to shake your hand after the debate, and they regard you as not simply wrong, but immoral. And they have a tremendous, suffusing sense of self-righteousness that informs them. So people come to debates, I think, to be in part to be entertained.
Yes, right.
In part, I think, to see someone humiliated. This is why attendances at debates are much larger than attendances at single lectures. Also to be informed, I think, and also to look at reform. And I think that we've tried to do a little of all. We were humorous in our debates. We try to be very substantive. These haven't been superficial at all. And yet I think we've tried to be constructive in trying to present a very concrete vision of how education
there
should be.
Stanley, I'll give you the last word.
There were political, in a sense, differences between us, and also personal differences between us. Dinesh
Not to mention generational differences.
Well, I was about to say, Dinesh is younger than I, and is also, as he sometimes said, a person of color. And that and both of those could be utilized in certain ways.
Did you lose the debate when he walked onto stage because of that?
Well, that's it depends.
He said I'm the only white male. You know, he used his.
And I'm an academic with a lot of experience, and sometimes I tried, and perhaps successfully at moments, to pull academic rank. So we were both working with what we had in the context of giving the audience the best account of a variety of very important subjects that we could. And I think, by and large, we succeeded very well.
Well, I want to thank you both for your contribution to Sounding. Stanley Fish, your latest book is Doing What Comes Naturally, Duke University Press. Dinesh D'Souza, your book, Illiberal Education, has just been published in paperback by Vintage. Thank you for coming by the National Humanities Center.
Thank you very much, Wayne.
My pleasure.
It's Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You've been listening to a conversation featuring Stanley Fish of Duke University and Dinesh D'Souza of the American Enterprise Institute. Stanley Fish's most recent book is Doing What Comes Naturally, published by Duke University Press. Dinesh D'Souza's book, Illiberal Education, is available from the Free Press. If you'd like a cassette copy of this program, please send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 626. That's number 626, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments. Next week, the New Zealand writer Russell Haley talks about his novel, Beside Myself. Jonathan Lamb of the University of Auckland discusses the 18th century voyages of Captain Cook to the South Pacific. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund Incorporated. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Cultural Conflicts, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for a conversation with Stanley Fish of Duke University and Dinesh D'Souza of the American Enterprise Institute, the perils and rewards of race, ethnicity, class, and gender in American education. Cultural Conflicts, this week on Soundings.